We're very happy to have Jemin here to give us a seminar about her interesting recent work on parity violation in the four-point function of Boss galaxies. Jemin got her PhD in 2020 from in Germany from the Max Planck Institute, and then has been a postdoc at the University of Florida, and in, later this year is starting as a Marie Sladowska Curie Fellow. Anyway, whenever you're ready, Jemin, please take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Laham, for the very nice introduction. And also, thank you for having me here to discuss our recent work on the parity violation search using the endpoint statistics of the large-scale structure. So there is a lot of information in the galaxy's three-dimensional distributions, and we can use them to map, for example, the expansion history of the universe, and we can use them to probe the growth rate of the cosmic structure, and also use them to understand the origin of the universe. And with that, we are arriving at a kind of standard cosmological paradigm where we have the cosmic inflation at the very early universe, and like with the single field inflation and also adiabatic perturbation as initial condition. And also there is the dark energy with the constant equation of state parameter equal minus one. And also there is the cold dark matter. However, we are not super happy about this paradigm for the reason I'm putting the question marks here, such as whether that could be the deviation from the single field and what is the nature of the dark energy, as well as what is the nature for the dark matter. And many cosmological surveys or galaxy surveys has been designed to answer that questions. And here I am taking the example from the SDSS, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and also its cosmological programs from the BOSS and also EBOSS. And in this illustration here, we are sitting at the center, and this big sphere is from the CMB background. And as we look back in time, going from the low redshift to the high redshift, here we have the LRG for the luminous red galaxies, we have ELGs for the emission line galaxy, and we have quasars, the quasars at different redshift. The lower sample was used for studying the large-scale structure, and also the higher redshift one was for the Lyman Alpha forest. And from these samples, one thing we can do is that we take the positions of these galaxies and come up with a map or a footprint. Here I'm showing the example that is taken from the quasars plotted as a declination and also the right ascension. So if we want to study like the two-point statistics of such a map, and one thing we can do is to look at the two-point correlation function and ask what is the probability excess of finding a galaxy pair for a given separation distance over a random distribution. And we can do this not only in the real space or configuration space, but we could also do it in the Fourier space. And there that we will be looking at the power spectrum. And then we could also do this exercise not only on the quasar, but also on other samples of galaxies. And here I am just coming up with this compiled diagram for different tracers. And on the left-hand side, you can see a measurement of the BAO distance ladder as a function of the redshift. And here are different panels shows different galaxy samples going from a very early sample from the SDSS, the main galaxy sample. And then we also have the LRGs, ELGs, quasars, Lyman Alpha forest. And on the right-hand side, it is a mirrored image to the left. And here it plots the growth rate as a function of the redshift. And here I'm also highlighting the two points that are the constraints we obtained with the quasars. And if we look back into the development in the last decades, going from the so-called stage two experiment to the stage three experiment, there are a lot of gains in different cosmological parameters for the matter, for the dark energy, the curvature, and also very exciting that we are almost on the edge of telling the neutrino mass hierarchy also from these constraints. So these are the things that we obtained with the 2-point statistics. And maybe you also want to ask that if we could go beyond that and put it differently, is there information also in the higher order statistics? So here I'm taking some snapshots from the Millennium simulation, and the time flows goes from the left to the right. And again, if we stay in the standard paradigm with a single field and also with adiabatic perturbation, then all the initial condition is just given by the Gaussian statistics. And there indeed, the 2-point function is enough to capture all of the information. However, as time goes on, the gravitational evolution will induce nonlinearities. And these are part of the information that are not fully captured by the 2-point statistics. And also, if we could bring in the higher order statistics, they will also provide unique windows to detect different inflationary models. And furthermore, they also help to break parameter degeneracies. And classical examples are the combination of the bias, the clustering bias, and also the sigma 8 or 12 for the matter fluctuation at a given radial distance. And here I am taking borrowing the figure that is from the paper by Guardiato. And in these triangular plots, it shows the constraints on the different parameters and different colors showing the information that we gain from combining the power spectrum, bispectrum, and up to the trispectrum. And from these plots here, we can see that indeed by bringing the higher order statistics, it helps not only to tighten the constraints on the standard lambda CDM parameters, but also helps to constrain primordial and Gaussianity parameters, which is, for example, parametrized by this FNL. And this is what happens in the Fourier space. And now if we go to the configuration space, going from the 2-point functions, and we could also extend this idea that for the 2-point correlation function, we are trying to sit on one galaxy, or we call it like the primary galaxy, and then we try to find one of its neighbors. So now if we want to calculate 3-point or 4-point, then we'll be sitting on one primary galaxy and looking for its two neighbors, or looking for its three neighbors. And also, instead of looking like a kind of sticker of a line, we'll also be looking for a triangle or for a tetrahedron and also higher orders. But then we also see that this problem becomes very expensive very, very soon. Like the problem will also scale as the number of galaxies to the power of n, where n being the number or being the endpoint statistics. And therefore, we just or try to push us to think that if there is ways to extract the information in a more efficient way. Given that we know that on the large scales, the galaxies are distributed isotropically. And we could, in an ideal case, we would also like to project the system onto a basis which itself has also rotational invariance. And that's why we're looking at this isotropic basis function, which was proposed by the paper by Kahn and also Slepian. And what we do there is that we try to expand the product of the density field into the isotropic basis function, which is denoted by this curly P lambda. And the isotropic function, it can be further expanded into products of spherical harmonics, and also with this weighting coefficient, the C lambda m, whereas this coefficient itself can be written as different combinations of the 3J symbols. So this basis is very nice because it is separable in Angular, and it offers to boost up the speed when we do the measurement. Which is saying that instead of trying to find the galaxy n tuplets, and in this case, we can still again do like a neighbor search. And then in the end, we accumulate the coefficients of the of finding the neighbors and onto the given primary and then sum them over. Therefore, it is much faster. In the past, we have been developing this estimator for the endpoint function. So the algorithm itself is also based on the paper by Slepian and Eisenstein for the 3-point function. And here you can view it as an extension of the basis where you use for the 3-point function or do the multiple expansion to the spherical harmonics. And also, when we are dealing with realistic surveys, and usually that comes up with quite non-trivial survey geometries, which can further induce the coupling between the angular momentum. And in this code, we also include this so-called edge corrections to correct for the survey geometry. And also, when we are talking about the four-point function, the four-point function, it can be decomposed into two parts. One is the so-called disconnected term, which can be written as the product of two-point correlation function and plus their cyclic terms. But this part does not really have new information because we already measured the two-point function before. However, there is also this connected piece, which has the real information that is brought by the higher order statistics. And also in this code, we can extract information from the connected for PCF alone. And also want to mention that very recently, this code has been GPU-nized. And this GPU'd version of the estimator has been run on the UF machine at Hypergator. On the right-hand side, I am showing a comparison for the GPU and versus the single-thread CPU. And it is plotted as a function for the ratio for the speed up, as a function of the different endpoint function for n equal 2 and up to 5. And here the takeaway message is that on the GPU version, it can speed up the calculation varying from 50 or to a factor of 200, depending on the different MPCF that you're looking at. And also now if you want to measure the four-point function on 1.5 million galaxies, it takes roughly only 1 minute. So this is really, really good, very exciting. And here in this plot, I am showing the first detection of the connected for PCF on the BOSS CMAS data. And on the left panel, I'm showing the four-point function. And in the upper panel, I'm showing the arrangement of the three radial bins. So in this case, we always arrange it such that, first of all, the bin one is smaller than two, then three. And also at one time, we try to fix bin one and bin two and then vary the third bin. And once we explore all the combination, then we move to the next bin, increase it by one index, and then vary the third bin again. So we just do this iteratively until we find out all the possible combination from the three radial bins. In the lower panel, I am showing the connected for PCF for a given combination of the angular order momentum, or we also call it like the angular channel. And in this case, I'm showing the L1 equal 2, L2 equal 0, L3 equal 2. And different colors in this plot shows the different sky for the north and also for the southern galactic hemisphere. And the solid line and also the dots represents the averaged mean value from the marks and also the measurement from the real data. So here we can see two things. First of all, the measurement from the data and also from the marks kind of agree that they show a similar oscillating pattern. And at the same time, both of them are deviating from zero. To the right of the slide, the plot shows the detection significance. And the solid line is the theoretical prediction for the statistics for the chi-square. Actually, in this case, I'm showing for the t-square distribution. And the histogram here shows the empirical distribution that is from the marks. And the dashed vertical line is the measurement from the BOSS data. So here we are seeing a sigma detection on this sample. And I also would like to say that this was the first detection of the gravitationally induced non-Gaussianity on the real data. And again, this is very exciting. But maybe to this point, you would also probably want to ask that, but then again, why do we really have to go to like the higher order statistics to go to the four-point function and even higher? And apart from the maybe tighter constraints on the cosmological parameters, or here we are seeing a non-vanishing detection, is there something else that cannot be achieved with a two-point or with the three-point function? And this brings this interesting ideas of the parity violation search with the four-point function of the large-scale structure. Maybe naively, we would expect that nature respects different kind of symmetries, and also parity is also one of them. But already from the 60s, from those neutrino experiments, we knew that the weak force does not preserve parity. And what this parity transformation does is that it tried to flip the spatial coordinates, like goes from x to minus x, y to minus y, c to minus c. And if here we had a line, or if we had a triangle, we can mirror it, but then we can always restore the original image by applying 180 degree rotation. However, if we have a tetrahedron here, I mean, we can still mirror it, but then if you rotate it, it will not be overlapping with its original image. So this is another way of saying that the four-point function is the lowest order statistics to be sensitive to a parity violation. And again, if we go back to our basis, what's happening here is that if we try to flip the R123 to the minus version, and here we will have an additional phase that is rising. So as long as the sum of the L123 being an odd number, then here we'll have this additional minus sign in front of the basis. And that's the reason why we are sensitive to the parity transformation. And maybe we also want to ask that, what does it mean then if there is a parity violation at cosmological scales? So first of all, in the standard single field inflation, there is no parity violating mechanism. And we also know that gravity is parity conserving. But then what are the possible sources for parity violation? And here I come up with a list of different parity violating mechanisms. I'm not sure if all of them will be producing a signal that is observable on the large scale at later time for the galaxies. And that is, but at the same time, I know that in the audience today, there are many theoreticians, and that is one thing I would like to hear also from your input. But I do want to point out to the first example for the Chern-Simon-like interactions, which describes, for example, there could be axions or inflaton that being coupled to gauge field or like a U1 gauge field. And there has been paper showing that in these cases, there can be indeed non-vanishing parity odd trispectrum for curvature perturbation. And because curvature perturbation, they are like the seeds of the large scale structure. So this is one of the possibility why we can see the distribution or having its imprint on the distribution of the galaxies at later time. And then just to give a more intuitive understanding of what I'm actually talking about for the parity odd for the four-point function. And here I have some toy model or toy simulation, and where I just try to throw in different tetrahedron or the open vertices. So once we are trying to sit on, for example, one of the primary vertices, and then looking for its three extending arms that are denoted by R1, R2, and R3. And here we always try to arrange the three arms such that R1 is smaller than R2, smaller than R3. And then once we are sitting on one of the primary vertices, and then looking for the orientation of the three arms, then it can either go clockwise or counterclockwise. And in that sense, we can also define some like effective handedness for the tetrahedron or for these open vertices. And on the right-hand side, I'm also showing some expressions for the Cartesian representation of the basis that we're using. And you could also notice that for each of these cases, they always come up with a cross product. And here I am taking an example for the P101 for the L1 equal L2 equal L3, they all equal one. And what I do is that then I will take these tetrahedron, then let them project onto the basis. And especially here, I am prepared three different kinds of simulations. So in the first case, we have all the tetrahedron that are oriented in a counterclockwise way. And in the second set of the simulation, all of them are oriented in a clockwise way. And there was also a third set of the tetrahedron that kind of a mixed. So half of them to be clockwise and half of them to be counterclockwise. And once we look at the coefficients, and for those pure tetrahedron with either clockwise or all counterclockwise, and they show these three peaks that appears just at the position where we expect them to be. And whereas if we go to this mixed type of the tetrahedron for half and half, and then they just canceled with each other, and this gray curve is pretty much consistent with zero. And then based on this intuition, we applied a measurement of the parity odd mode search on the BOS data. And in this sample, we looked at two subsamples from the BOS. One is the CMAS. It sits at high redshift from 0.4 to 0.7, which has roughly 800K galaxies. And the other sample is for the low C. It is at a low redshift from 0.2 to 0.4. And it also has roughly 280,000 galaxies. And I also want to say that
I think Lee has a question. I don't know if you...
Yes, please go ahead.
So Lee, you're muted.
There, is that okay? Yes.
Yes.
Jess, could you remind us what the relationship of these observables is to the old discussions on TB modes and things like that?
Here we are not sensitive to T or B modes because we are just using the positions of the galaxies. It is like treating each of the galaxy as a point, and then we look at the internal configuration of the galaxies. And if we want to look for like a T modes or B modes, maybe you need to also combine information. For example, if you are talking the context of the CMB, then maybe you also need to bring in the CMB photons. Or if you are thinking of the TMB modes for the weak lensing, then you also need to bring in the shape of the galaxy. But that would be a different discussion.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I guess I will continue. Okay. Right. Another thing I want to mention is that here we are opt for a model independent search, which means that we do not specify any specific model into the mocks, and also we are doing a null hypothesis, which means that we have to be very careful about our estimation for the statistical background. And to that regard, another challenge is that we have a very high dimensionality for the four-point function, which means that we cannot also directly use the sampling covariance matrix from the mocks because we need to invert the covariance matrix. And therefore, we are looking at three different methods for estimating the covariance matrix as alternatives. So first of all, we looked at an analytic covariance matrix and with the Gaussian assumption. And then another thing that we can do is that we could use, for example, like the recipe from the paper by Scoshimalu 1999, and then try to use the basis of the analytic covariance matrix to, on the one hand, select the eigenvectors from the data that are associated with the n's smallest eigenvalues, and at the same time, use that to decompose the mock covariance. And furthermore, if we could further reduce the degree of freedom, and then we can, by, for example, restrict a given combination of the angular momentum or the angular channel or the radial bins. And in that way, we could also use the direct method from the mocks. And here, another caveat here is the mocks that we're using is from the patchy mocks. And we had worried that because the patchy mocks use the approximate method, and you might think that, okay, that it could not necessarily give the very correct nonlinear prediction or the nonlinear gravitational evolution when we go to the small scales. And also in the mock paper, it has been shown that if we go to the large scales, there is some discrepancy between the mean and the mocks and also the data. So again, we can have a different interpretation. The difference could be because there is still some residual systematics in the data that is not being fully corrected, but that could also just because of the statistical fluctuation. Therefore, we first looked at reduced Bing data vector by cutting out the small scale and also the large scale. So by doing that, the another advantage is that we can use the mock covariance matrix directly. And here I want to first draw your attention to the histogram, the black histogram, which is the empirical distribution from the mocks. And then the solid curve is the prediction from a T-square distribution for a given degree of freedom. And the vertical orange line is the measurement from the data. And the separation between the vertical line and also the distribution give us the detection significance. And in this case, we are seeing still like a 5.5 sigma detection, and which give us the confidence that we could move forward. But then if we want to bring in like all the degree of freedom, then either we want to use the data compression approach, or if we want to use the analytic covariance matrix, then we have to have the template for that. And in the next, I would also like to spend some words on discussing how do we do the calculation for the covariance matrix and what are the assumptions we made that went into it and what can be still improved to do this calculation. So when we are talking about the covariance, essentially we are asking that how do we correlate two copies of density fields. And the first approximation we make here is under the Gaussian limit, which reduces this problem of calculating a pair of the density field at one time. For example, we calculate the covariance between a density field that is sitting at R1 with R1 prime, 2 with 2 prime, 3 and 3 prime. And now we look at this problem that is just a calculation of the two-point correlation function. We know how to do the two-point correlation function, and we also know how to express the two-point function in the isotropic basis. So here we have some phase term, and we have this F kernel or the F function, which is from the Fourier transformation of the two-point function. And we also have this D and also C coefficients, which are just coming from the basis. And here comes the second approximation we are doing here, which is saying that we are treating the real space covariance matrix or the isotropic covariance. What I essentially mean here is that we ignore the coupling of the higher order multiples of the power spectrum to the covariance structure. And furthermore, if you like, actually we liked, so we also introduced this tripolar structure to denote this basic element. And then the calculation of the four-point function covariance can be viewed a bit like playing a Lego game. Like you have these basic elements for the tripolar structure, and you also have this coupling kernel, which arises from averaging the rotation angles. And you put them together, and then you arrive at this left, the right diagram that represents the covariance matrix. And of course, we can also write them down in the mathematical expression. I'm not going to go through each terms that is in this expression, but I do want to emphasize that this is one of the contribution to the calculation. And there is another term that looks similar, but slightly more complicated. And both of them will enter the calculation for the four-point function. And then how does that compare to the simulations? Just as a recap, the assumption that we are making so far is the Gaussianity, the isotropy. And again, by isotropy here, I mean that we ignore the coupling between the power spectrum multiple to the covariance. And a third assumption that we have been making here is that we assume the window function to be uniform. And in our previous paper, we have performed a series of analysis on the comparison for the covariance and also to the simulation. And there we understood that the window function seems to be having the dominating effect on the among the three assumptions. And also its impact can be partially integrated by varying the covariance matrix for the shot noise and also for the volume. And in the plots here, I'm showing is the comparison for the analytic covariance matrix to the simulation. To the left panel here is the correlation matrix, which is the covariance matrix normalized by its diagonals. And in the upper triangle, I'm showing the analytic prediction of the correlation matrix. And in the lower one is the one that is measured from the mock simulation. Yes, I just saw there is a hand raised.
Hi, yeah, thanks. Sorry, I have another question. I was wondering, among the systematics in the comparison with simulations, could there be other physical effects, say redshift space distortion, your role? Because that could misplace a bit the position of your galaxies.
Yeah, this is a very good question. Actually, just after this, I'm going to discuss systematics.
I'll wait then, sir.
Yeah, I will come back to this point later. But thank you for the question now already. Let's be a bit patient for the moment, and we stay in the statistics discussion for a while. And here to the left panel, we can see the comparison. And by eye, it's pretty hard to distinguish the difference between the analytic and also the mock covariance matrix, which is again saying that the analytic method seems to be able to capture the features from the mock covariance matrix. And in the middle panel here, I'm showing the so-called half inverse test. And the idea here is that if the two matrices are indeed the same, then we can take the matrix and then multiply it by its inverse. And then that will just give us an identity matrix. So if we subtract by the identity matrix, we should expect to see zeros. And in this plot here, we can see that the sigmas, which stands for the standard deviation of each of the matrix element for the number of the mocks, and the standard deviation pretty much agrees as what we expect for the 2000 mocks. However, here, if we look closely on the diagonals, we can see there is a non-vanishing residuals, which is appearing there, which is telling us what is the residual between the analytic covariance matrix and also the mock covariance. And again, if we look at the right panel, here I'm showing the diagonal elements of the covariance matrix. And in the lower ones, I'm showing the ratio between the patchy and also the analytic. And again, we can see that although they being close to one, however, there is a difference between the two approaches, which is saying that yes, they are indeed different. And regarding the assumption that we have been making, we could, in principle, include the higher order statistics, for example, also calculate the contribution from the bispectrum from those 3-3-2 types, or even go to the trispectrum and so on. And if we do that, it will induce, again, quite some of the non-trivial coupling structures in the covariance matrix. And also, in principle, we could include the window function. And what we have done so far is that we have analytically written down what is the anisotropic extension of the covariance matrix by including the coupling of the power spectral multiple to the covariance matrix. And also we have extended the formalism for n that is larger than 4, such that we don't necessarily only need to look at the 4-point function, but we can also look at the 5 or 6-point function if we want to go beyond in the future. And in the next, I'm going to, there are one more slide. And so when we go for the full data vector, and there is also no real surprise that the detection significance also increases. And along that line, we have also tried to vary different thin intervals. And the overall observation is that here we see that the detection significance drops as the interval increases. So for that, what we have understood is a so-called internal cancellation. And this is our, so far, our conjecture on this behavior. And what do I mean by the internal cancellation is that once we are looking at these vertices and they can have their handedness, and they will also have an associated plus or a minus sign. And some of them can be the real signal and some of them can be the noise. And in the extreme case, if we just using a very coarse binning and all of them will be just co-added onto a single triple bins, and then they will be canceling with each other. So in an ideal world, we would like to like only select those configurations that has the real signals and which is happening to the toy models, where we exactly know where to look for the signals, and so that is the reason why if we use a finer binding, and then we can hope to get a less cancellation between the different configurations of the tetrahedron. And now we can move to the impact of the systematics. And here, broadly speaking, I will divide them into three categories for the survey-related effects or observer-induced effects, or those are related to the algorithm. And in the following, I'm going to give one example for each of these effects. But before that, I would also like to provide an intuition for those systematics that we would be mostly worried about. And so here we will be mostly worried about by those so-called 3D effects. And the intuition here is that if we just consider there is some modulation on the sky plane, and then we can kind of flip the sky plane. And but that in that case, it will not like really induce a further imbalance in the configuration of the tetrahedron. And versus if we have a so-called like a 3D systematics that could lead to a flip in the parity of each of the tetrahedron, that's also coupled to the signals for the parity odd mode. And one example that we have been very worried about in the boss is the so-called redshift failure. So just as a recap, in the boss, we have these aluminum plates, and on these plates, you will drill holes and then plug in the fibers. And in the middle panel, I'm showing a redshift failure rate that is plotted on the focal plane. And here, the different redness of these dots represents the degree of the redshift failure rate. So here in this plot, you can see that the distribution, it is not symmetric on the plate. And by this effect alone, we will not be super worried about it. But the correction for the redshift failure is that you try to upweight the nearest neighbors of the galaxies. However, for those galaxies that are most likely to get lost, they are the fainter galaxies and also at high redshift. But then the replacement you do there would be a random draw from all of the NFC distribution. So this is a thing that can couple the 2D asymmetry also onto the radial direction. And by the way, I also want to mention that the redshift failure on the focal plane is also very tightly coupled to the position or the average position of the fiber IDs. And in the CMOD sample, there are about 2% of the objects that suffer from the redshift failure rate. And we have studied that. And from what we understand is that this effect by itself is not super, super worrying on the data, but there's another caveat associated to that. I will come back to it later. And then related to the observer-induced effect, and here I'm taking the example that is a very nice illustration from paper by Hilada in 2009. So what can happen here is that if we consider there is some, say, density field modulation that is perpendicular to the sky plane, then what can happen there is that for those galaxies that are sitting in the density peak, they will try to be aligned that is a parallel to the line of sight. Whereas for those galaxies that are perpendicular to or that are sitting in density trough, they will be aligned perpendicular to the line of sight. And once we try to put an aperture on the sky, then for those galaxies in a density trough, they are most likely to get lost. And there will be a very similar effect for those for the density field if there is a modulation that is parallel to the line of sight. And also in the paper, it has been shown nicely that if such effect exists, that can lead to indeed a modulation in the observed density field, which is for this delta, for the galaxy density fluctuation that is modulated by this epsilon function, whereas this epsilon function is a function of n hat for the line of sight, and for this k, which is the wave vector associated with the given galaxy. And what we'll do for the four-point function is that we'll try to multiply four copies of such density field, and then we'll project them onto the parity odd basis. But here we also notice that for each of these functions, they are parity even. And once you multiply them, project onto the parity odd mode, that is not going to contribute. And another...
Can I ask a question before you go on this? Yes. Do you mind going back? So what if there's a... there's an effect that's modulated by the line of sight velocity rather than the tidal effect? because that would be parity odd.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, we could also write down the terms for such a modulation if we could like combine them. But maybe I could also come back to this later. For example, if we consider like those Kaiser rocket effect, which is saying that if we are not fixed with respect to the CMB background, so if we consider such an effect, then to the leading order, the signal will be first of all suppressed by the peculiar velocity of the galaxies. And secondly, if we do, for example, like the multiple expansion, then we'll also be suppressed by the distance of the observed galaxy towards us. And I think in the end, that will be a still very small contribution. And actually, for such a kind of effect, we are also trying to prepare a follow-up paper on this effect.
Okay, so you're saying you're studying this to see whether that, but you think you're, based on your current calculation, is too small, this velocity dependent effect, if there is any?
Yeah. Okay. So if we like estimate the peculiar velocity at a several hundred kilometer per second, but then it will be scaled by the speed of the light. And again, for the galaxies that are at the redshift, say 0.5, that is about 1 gigaparsec over h in distance. And compared to separation that you are looking at, that would be only a few percent effect, then multiplied by 10 to the minus 3.
Right. No, but I guess the thing is, it also could depend on the spectrum of the galaxies, in the sense that you may have galaxies that they have an edge in their spectrum, and if they're blue shifted or red shifted, they may be detected because of that edge. So that's the kind of effect that I'm imagining, that it's because it could depend on the spectrum. It's not just the geometric effect, but it may depend on the spectrum.
Can you explain a bit more what you mean by the edge of the spectrum?
Well, all I'm just saying that if you have some spectral features for the galaxy, and so if your observational band, the sensitivity of your telescope, say your spectral line or feature is within that band, you can see it, but if it's outside that band, you wouldn't see it. So because of this redshift or blue shift, you could see a galaxy or not see a galaxy, basically. Now, it is suppressed by speed of light, but it's something that also depends on the spectrum of galaxy that you're looking at.
Yeah, so I think...
I was just going to, we can talk more about it if you want. I don't want to slow down your talk.
Okay, do I have still 10 minutes left or?
Yeah, 15 minutes.
Okay, how about I proceed now and then we come back to the discussion?
Sounds good.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good. Sure. And then again about the algorithm. So as I mentioned also in the beginning that we are trying to, or because of the non-trivial survey geometry that will lead to so-called edge correction. And what does that do is that if we look at the estimated four-point function at a given combination of the angular channel, then it will receive a contribution from this M matrix. And for this M matrix, it will take two arguments for the lambda and also lambda prime. And if we look at this plot, what I'm doing is I'm taking the M matrix, subtract by its diagonal elements. And for these non-vanishing off-diagonal terms, which is telling us that there could indeed be coupling of the parity even combination to the parity odd configuration. But then the next question to ask that is, how big is the amplitude of this additional contribution? And on the right-hand side, I'm plotting the ratio for the R. For the R is the random at the order of the L123, and that is normalized by the R of 000. So seeing this amplitude at the order of 10 to the minus 6, which is saying that it is very small, and we do not really think that this is the reason that we are seeing such a high detection significance. And in addition to that, what we can do is we could go to the mocks and then look at different systematics for the fiber collision, Beetle mask, selection function, and then turn on and off for different weights. And in this plot here, you can see that after doing this, the distribution for different cases are still pretty well agreement with the predicted curve for the T-square distribution. And what we can also do is that we go to the data and then split them into different area or subregions, then looking for anomalies. And what we have seen is that the detection from the variation of all these different patches are also allowed by the statistical fluctuation from each of the subregions. And another thing that is coming to the question related to the Kaiser rocket effect, which is saying that we also know that we're not fixed with respect to the CMB background. But we just had a short discussion about that, but we can also come back to this later again. And so far, I've been trying to convince you that it seems that our detection is stable. But it really does not mean that we don't have potential questions. And actually, here I'm coming up with a non-exhaustive list for the potential questions we would like to answer. So first of all, if we do have a signal that is in the data, don't we expect to see also a correlation that is across the sky, which means that we might well expect that the coherent pattern that is appearing both in the north and also for the south galactic cap. And in this plot, I am trying to plot the coefficient for the Pearson correlation coefficient and use that to quantify if we do see this coherent oscillation by comparing different caps. But sadly, what we found there is the correlation coefficient to be pretty much consistent with zeros. And we have also come up with a toy model to see that if it is possible at all to have some detection significance, but at the same time have very low detection, have very low correlation. And what we understand from the toy model is that right now we are at a region with very low signal to noise ratio and probably with an upper bound only about 20%. And next, I've also been trying to convince you that it's very hard for systematics to be coupled to the signal. But what I haven't said is that the systematics, they, if they enter the data, they could also induce additional variance in the data. And at the same time, if we do not properly incorporate them into the covariance, that could also lead to an underestimate of the covariance and then leads to an artificially high detection significance. So also to answer that question, one thing we did is to do the self-calibration with the parity even mode. And the idea there is that if there is indeed such a thing or systematics enters the data, then it may well induce the variance for the parity even and also parity odd mode in a kind of comparable amplitude or the fraction, which is of saying that we can rescale the detection significance from the parity odd sector depending on what we see for the parity even mode. So we also do this exercise on the data, and after doing the correction, we are still seeing like a 4 sigma detection significance. And also additionally, in the beginning, I also mentioned that we looked at 2 BOT samples for the CMAS and also for the low C. And the question is, do we have the consistency there also for the low C? And yes, for the low C, we're also seeing like a 3 sigma detection, but that is much lower than the CMAS. And what could be the cause for that? Is it just because for the low C, the volume gets smaller and we have a less number of galaxies objects, or we could have different properties for the low C than CMAS, such as for CMAS, we know there are like 25% of them to be blue galaxies. And is this because of the galaxy population? And if so, then why is that? And also for low C and CMAS, they have a different NFC distribution. But again, why this will give us different detection significance? So these are the questions we would like to answer in the follow-up studies. And as a very quick summary, in this talk, I've been talking about the endpoint function algorithm and show the detection of connected for PCF about the analytic covariance matrix. And I've been also showing that the 4-point function of the large scale structure, it can be used to test for parity violation. And here we have seen that there is a statistically significant detection. So if it is true, that would be great. And also it would likely mean there is the non-Gaussian initial condition. But in order to validate whether this is a physics origin or due to something else, we really have to see them on the future data set. But nevertheless, it opens an avenue to study the parity violation with the large scale structure. And in the next stage of the galaxy surveys, there will be different types. Some of them will be spectroscopic oriented, or some of them will be photometric, and some of them will be space, and some of them will be ground-based. And here I especially would like to mention the DAISY for the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument. It started 5-year survey, and so far has been doing an amazing job, that is collecting about 18 million spectra and also with 2.7 million LRGs. So for DAISY, the very good thing is, on the one hand, it has a very similar properties compared to BOSS, like both of them are spectroscopic surveys, and they will have a very similar samples and also at the redshift the distributions, and also both of them use a fiber system. And at the same time, they also have different design such as the fiber assignment, like using these robotics, and also the imaging selections and so on. So if we can see these signals again on the DAISY, that would be a very intriguing thing. And also here in this work, we have been opt for a model independent search, which has pros and cons. The good thing is that we don't need to be dependent on any model. But at the same time, we also have a very large degree of freedom, and maybe some of them could be also non-physical. So if we could have a model for parity odd signal, that will give us a much clearer guide of what are the interesting scales and what are the interesting angular channels that we should look for, and also make the search much more effective. And also it will be very helpful to have a simulation with a parity violating mechanism, such as either using like lattice simulation or with the initial condition that has a parity breaking mechanism. And then last but not least, coming to the systematics. So also in this work, we have been mainly focusing on the known systematics, especially to the BOSS. But that really does not say that we have we also have a lot of other systematics that we could have been worried about, such as in some of the forward modeling paper, they have also been showing that if we look at different color band, and also some of them could have shown even a redshift dependent evolution in the residual modulations. And these are the type of things that we would love to inject in the future marks, and then to see how much that will impact our analysis. And I think with that, I end up with my discussion. And also, thank you for listening. And please, if you have questions.
Okay, great. Let's thank Xiaomin for a great talk. And please chime in with questions.
Yes. Did you look at, there are other observables besides these things that come from decomposing the four-point functions in terms of angular variables, because there are geometrical or topological functions that we could draw in the sky that are parity odd. For example, if we start with projections of knots, and imagine making a projection of the simplest knots onto the sky, then the simplest knots, the trefoils, distinguish left-handed from right-handed. And these would also come from the theories based on Chern-Simon theory on the boundary.
These are very interesting ideas. So far, we haven't looked at other, say, configurations or geometries that is from the LSS. But just because you are saying that, that reminds me of like the cosmic birefringence work done by the CMB people. And I think in those cases, if both of the two studies indicate some real signals that could be also well explained by the Chern-Simon-like models, maybe either from the primordial or maybe from the late time, or maybe that's the same mechanism that just acts through the cosmic times.
I think you have to distinguish between two different kinds of Chern-Simon models. there were the ones that people originally looked at, where you have basically a field strength, either of a Yang-Mills field or the gravitational field, and you have F wedge F times the scalar field. And when that scalar field is not constant, you get observables which are parity-on, which are in some sense local. But those theories involve a scalar field, and to my mind, they're not very elegant. But there are also extensions of general relativity, which are parity-on. We studied with Zhao Mingguizhou and Stefan Alexander and some other people. We studied these extensively. These have a variable cosmological constant, and they have torsion in the geometry.
Please go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh, I wanted to ask that if in this case, do you mean like if there could be the coupling also to the tensor sector instead of to the F mu, I see.
Well, no, but let's be careful. My F is a field strength of the gravitational field, or the curvature, the vial curvature of the gravitational field. It's not related to an axion field.
So your F mu nu is related to the curvature or not to the curvature?
Yes, it's related to the curvature of the gravitational field. And the integral of trace F wedge F is parity on. Mm-hmm. But the connection field is not the Christoffel connection. It has additional terms in it which are related to the torsion of the gravitational field, for example.
Okay. Yeah.
So these would be effects that would be important in quantum theories of gravity, I think, more than things in the later universe.
Right. And from this model, do you have intuition that if can lead to direct distribution in the change of the galaxy density field, or does that like having indirect impact on, for example, producing some non-vanishing tidal or shear that kind of indirectly impacted the distribution of the large scale structure?
I'm not sure. I can more easily see the second intuitively, but it would be nice to, I'm not sure that we can't pick out densities or pattern densities.
Right.
It's very good to think about.
I see another hand raised.
So I just wanted to maybe follow up on what I was trying to ask you before. So basically, my main question is that the galaxies that are selected for the samples are based on some sort of photometric criterion, that there's flux in some band that you say, okay, if they're above some limit, then you put them in your sample. But the flux that we observe in your observed band, it's of course, it depends on the spectrum of the galaxy, and it depends on the redshift or blue shift. So imagine that you have a galaxy that has some a spectral emission line, a bright emission line. And if there could be two galaxies that are the same redshift or same distance, but then one of them is moving towards you, the other is moving away from you. So the spectral line could move into your observational band for your instruments for one of them, and the other one, it may not. So you may include one of them in your sample, but the other one you wouldn't include your sample. So basically what I'm suggesting is that there could be an additional dependence on radial velocity, which modulates your survey. So it's similar to the one that effect that from Chris Hirata that you mentioned with the tidal effect, but in this one with the velocity, not the tidal effect. And the velocity is parity odd. I'm just wondering whether that could be an important effect.
Yeah, so for the selection of galaxy, for the boss, it is divided into two step. So first of all, you just look at image and then you select according to the colors.
Yep.
And then you go to the spectrum and then you fit like the features from the spectrum.
Right.
The LRDs that could be different than for quasars or for emission lines. There are, for example, for quasars, you will look for example, like the magnesium lines, or you may also combine with some carbon lines. And for the ELGs, that is also some more specific lines. But I think for LRGs, that in addition to maybe some specific features, you also look at the broad distribution of the spectrum. So,
but I'm asking about the first step that you mentioned, that there's the first step is you do a photometry and you pick some things that are brighter than some limit. And in that step, there could be this velocity modulation, that things that are moving toward, well, could be moving towards or away, because it depends on the spectral line and relative to the observable band. So that, go ahead, sorry.
Sorry. I think in this case, you really have to have a very large velocity modulation such that you distort either the color or the entire spectrum of the galaxy, such that you miss this object completely as the LRGs. I mean, there could be some like global modulations. Maybe if you have maybe some dust or something that just do not think that is an LRGs. But I think if just by the movement of a single galaxy, it will be quite hard to make such a huge change due to the velocity.
Okay, so I promise this is the last question. But if you change the limits, so because the magnitude limit of the sample, does the amplitude of this parity odd effect change?
That's a good question. I haven't tried to like rebuild the Bose sample, because I think that is quite an untrivial work to do, because you need to match not only for the galaxy, you also need to recalibrate such as the sector completeness, and you also need to relook at all of the different systematics and rebuild the entire catalog.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Hi. Can you, in order to distinguish these things, like choose your tetrahedra to have parity reflections only in certain directions? So for example, only parity inversion along the line of sight versus only parity inversion transverse to the line of sight?
Right. That's something maybe I can do it on a simulation. That right now we are not able to tell like from this and this, I am seeing the tetrahedron look like this or that. But like in the toy model that I was showing, that I can just flip the parity of the, or just flip the tetrahedron that is either with respect to a given direction. So in that sense, if I just flip the tetrahedron along the direction, that would be just like doing a global rotation of the box. And in that sense, nothing happens, because you will still project the whole thing onto a given isotropic basis. Right. If I have a box that is oriented like this, and now I just flip it, just to, instead of viewing it from the positive C direction rather than viewing it from the negative C direction, that will not happen anything, because the orientation of the tetrahedron that are still fixed within this box. So what does happen is that if I go to each of the tetrahedron, and then I say that, okay, instead of having a tetrahedron that is aligned for R123 with respect to the XYZ coordinate, but now I flip my definition of the XYZ coordinate, then that will flip the parity at each individual tetrahedron level.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Yes, please.
Hi, Jimin. Thanks for the really nice talk. This is really really interesting.
Thank you.
So I was wondering, in these analyses, there's no like theory template for the parity odd four-point function, right? So it's more like what you're detecting is more like variance in the parity odd four-point function relative to Mach.
Yes.
So then how sensitive are the results to modeling the the power spectrum of the data? Like if the Mach had a power spectrum which was 1% different from the data, say, would that significantly bias the analysis?
So here we're not looking at the modeling as you said. And maybe just let me to understand the question is, are you asking how sensitive will be sensitive to a parity odd say model, or how are we sensitive to a standard say model for the power spectrum given some nonlinear evolution?
I guess I was just wondering, like, you're finding that the you're estimating the 4-point function in a large number of bins, like say 10,000 bins, where the bins are defined both through by selecting radial scales and spins. And what you're finding is that length 10,000 vector has more variance than you expect from Mach.
Yes.
So then, one way you would get more variance without a preferred sign or anything, just more variance, is if the Mach were just, had less power than the data. Is that something that you looked at?
So for the comparison to the Mach, I mean, we use the Mach as the estimation of the covariance matrix. So there are some of the, caveats that we discussed, which is saying that if we go to the small scale, we do worry that it can lose the power for predicting the covariance matrix. And also if we go to the large scale, there could be some discrepancy between the Mach and also the covariance matrix. So that was the motivation that we tried to cut out those scales and to see what is going on. And another thing that I didn't really got time to mention is that when we are trying to calculate the covariance, it is not only the three legs of the covariance matrix that enters. There is also, we need to do also an additional integral that is for the separation between these two copies of the tetrahedron. Then you will need to integrate it from the very small scale and also to the large scale. So that is another thing that we can't really just by doing the cutout for the scales for the covariance matrix. But we did look at the kernels for this integration and to see that at which scale does that contribute. So it is not at those very, very small scales, which the kernel roughly look like this, and then cutout is at the like several tens of megaparsec over H. So like based on these, then for the missing power of the covariance matrix, because at the moment it just enters the covariance matrix. And that's why we think that even though it is based on some approximation method, but that should still be something, on the one hand, that is the best we can do at the moment. And on the other hand, that could still be something understandable or trustworthy. And then coming to the model just about the parity odd itself. So that is maybe a bit different than what you asked originally, but I think it will be very interesting that if there is such a parity breaking, say, models, then usually it also comes up with a parity even part. So if we could taking both of them and then look at the data and then do a joint analysis for both the parity even and also for the parity odd mode, I think that would be something quite, on the one hand, at least it will allow us to rule out some of the parameter spaces for some given model. But at the same time, that will also give us some insight of what is going on happening at both of the sector, because we think we understand what is going on in the parity even sector, right? Just by the gravitational evolution.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, let me know if I answered your question. Lee, please.
Yes, so one of the kinds of models that root this parity odd behavior in gravity and quantum gravity is to look at what happens if you divide the gravitational field into helicities. So you have positive and negative helicities, and you try to give them different Newton's constants. You try to complete the construction of general relativity, but with different left-handed and right-handed Newton's constants. And you can do that. You basically get conditions on what you have to destroy something sacred, like locality or Lorentz invariance to do that, but you can do that. And then you see a signal by looking at the difference between speeds of the gravitational field for left-handed and right-handed polarizations of the gravitational waves. Is that related to the things that you measured?
Actually, I was maybe more thinking about just looking at the distribution of the galaxy distribution. And from there, like if we are looking at the four-point function, then you can divide it into a parity even and also a parity odd mode. But I think what you mentioned is also very interesting. I guess that would be looking forward if we can make some direct observable on the gravitational wave to distinguish the left versus the right-handed graviton.
Yes.
Yeah, but for that one, I guess you also need to have modification instead of to the scalar part, but to the tensor part of, for example, like for the Chern-Simon models, right?
Right. You certainly end up modifying the tensor part of the right. Because that's the, there are no scalar propagating modes in general. It's all tensor.
Right.
Anyway, it's very, very interesting.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so that sounds like a great place to stop. Thanks, Gemma. That was a great great talk, great presentation. Thank you again. Very good. Well, so let's see. So people can stay in chat. I have to run, but let me just make sure that if I log out that I won't log everyone out by accident.
Oh, thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.